Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Act-Informed Exposure for Anxiety, Creating Effective, Innovative, and Values-Based Exposures Using Acceptance and Commitment Therapy by Brian L. Thompson, Ph.D., Brian C. Pilecki, Ph.D., and Joanne C. Chan, PSYD. Foreword by Stephen C. Hayes, Ph.D. Narrated by Jennifer Aquino. Foreword. Why ACT needs exposure and exposure needs ACT. Exposure is often spoken of as one of the crown jewels of evidence-based therapy. Here is a method that helps about half of the clients who try it and has a mountain of supportive evidence across a wide range of problem areas. In part as a result, nearly every introductory text in psychology includes exposure case examples, and often these examples are used to highlight explanations that have been repeated so often they have become almost truisms, such as the supposedly key role of reductions of arousal during exposure sessions. It is good to have a crown jewel, but we must be honest. The fact is that exposure is a method we still do not fully understand. Simple conditioning or habituation explanations cannot fully explain it. Traditional cognitive and emotional processing explanations falter as well. And yes, spontaneous reductions of arousal during exposure sessions also fail. It now appears that what is most key is new learning, not eliminating the emotional echoes of the past. Being better able to observe and describe emotions may be important. Persistence is important. But the jewel is still, shall we say, unpolished. It is still a method or technique, not a well-understood process or set of processes. Acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, was always cast as an exposure-based treatment simply because the processes it targets, such as emotional and cognitive openness, flexible attention to the now, and values-based behavior commitments, all readily bring people into contact with previously repertoire narrowing experiences. ACT naturally leads to exposure to previously avoided thoughts, feelings, memories, sensations, or situations. Unlike traditional exposure, ACT does not seek or promise elimination of emotional arousal. The point was more the creation of greater life freedom, the ability to live the kind of life you choose via greater psychological flexibility. As exposure-based ACT research began in earnest in the last decade and a half, it was found that it did indeed produce positive outcomes and did so generally via changes in psychological flexibility or related concepts. The flexibility-based view of exposure, namely that it is organized presentation of previously repertoire-narrowing stimuli in a context designed to ensure repertoire expansion, has held up reasonably well. It fits broadly with what we are learning about exposure from many different modern laboratories. But in the last few years, we have also learned that the gains for ACT exposure were about the same as with the best existing exposure methods. That was undeniably a disappointment. But science is science, and we learn as much or more from our failures as our successes. Is that the end of the story? A fair answer is that we do not yet know. We do know that radically transdiagnostic methods are gaining ground, and that ACT is rapidly assuming a role as a central method in modern evidence-based intervention worldwide. It is doing that not because it is spectacularly better in any one area, but rather because its putative process of change are robust, and they are incredibly broadly applicable. More than half of the known successful mediators of change for any psychosocial method in randomized trials focused on mental health outcomes are measures of psychological flexibility and its closely associated concepts. Over 1,000 randomized trials of ACT show that the same model and same basic methods produce positive changes that usually meet or beat best-of-breed targeted alternatives across every kind of problem area or positive prosperity challenge you can name, from relationships to addiction, from panic to managing diabetes, from burnout to reducing the harmful impact of prejudice. And that is one major reason for this very book. If we know that ACT is important and exposure is important, is exposure important for ACT? The authors argue successfully that the answer is yes. This book shows that exposure in an ACT context can be thought of as simply another ACT experiential exercise that can help clients orient to the ACT model. Exposure offers an advantage over traditional ACT experiential exercises in its focus on repetition. Through repetition of specific exposure exercises conducted in a variety of contexts, clients have greater opportunity to experience ACT processes and practice psychological flexibility when in contact with previously repertoire-narrowing stimuli. In short, if clients don't understand ACT concepts such as willingness, then exposure is a great way for them to contact ACT processes experientially. In other words, exposure is a way to do better ACT work. Exposure is a context, a platform, and unlike lots of alternative contexts for ACT work, it's done where the rubber meets the road. It's real, situational, behavioral, and repeatable. It is not just more talking. That is a hugely important idea, and one that is as behaviorally sensible as an idea can be. But if exposure is helpful to ACT, is ACT helpful to exposure? I think there, too, the answer is yes. Here's why. When you compare ACT exposure to, say, traditional CBT exposure, the outcomes are similar, but not necessarily the moderators. For example, if you are working with multi-problem people, such as those who are diagnosable with an anxiety disorder and a mood disorder, ACT-based exposure produces better gains than CBT-based exposure. This means that you must consider client fit. It is not the only study finding different moderators for ACT-based exposure as compared to CBT-based exposure. The deep message of findings like this is not that ACT-based exposure makes no difference as compared to CBT or other methods, but that it does make a difference, depending on the client. Now add to that the fact that we are currently examining mediation and moderation only through the filter of top-down normative statistics instead of using person-specific measurement and analysis, what is being called idiomatic statistics. In other words, we are using statistical methods to find treatment moderation and mediation that treat people as error terms, not individuals. And yet, even through that darkened window, we see that ACT helps some people, but not all people, better than existing best-of-breed methods. Doesn't that mean you need to learn ACT-based exposure if you work with populations that need exposure? I think it means precisely that. On both grounds, if you are a person interested in either exposure or ACT, you need this book. The authors do a wonderful job covering every detail of how to do ACT-based exposure. The voice is calm and reassuring. The writing is clear and helpful. The advice is detailed and evidence-based. It is simply the best book available on this topic. And with that, I will turn you, the listener, over to the author's capable hands with this simple message. This is an important book on an important area. I believe it will make a difference in the lives of those you serve. Stephen C. Hayes, Ph.D., Foundation Professor of Psychology, University of Nevada, Reno. Originator and co-developer of acceptance and commitment therapy. Background: History, Research, Current Trends. Chapter 1: A Process-Based Approach to Exposure for Anxiety Disorders. Exposure therapy involves the systematic confrontation of anxiety-provoking stimuli while refraining from avoidance behaviors. For example, any behavior aimed at reducing fear or discomfort. It's one of the major success stories in the treatment of anxiety disorders in adults, as well as children and adolescents. Whenever I, Brian T., start to tell someone about my background in exposure therapy, I have to stop myself from saying, "My first exposure to exposure was..." Therefore, my first, experience with exposure was prolonged exposure, PE, for PTSD. An exposure-based cognitive behavioral treatment for individuals with PTSD, PE, consists of psychoeducation, a brief introduction to deep breathing, and then exposure, exposure, and more exposure. I've always admired the relative simplicity and elegance of the PE protocol. There are only a handful of worksheets in the protocol, and the focus of the treatment is almost entirely on exposure. There are a number of exposure-based interventions. PE is just one of them. Others include exposure with response or ritual prevention for obsessive-compulsive disorder and written exposure therapy for PTSD. However, many treatment protocols I've picked up since learning PE have felt unnecessarily cluttered by comparison. Look at all these worksheets and handouts, I'd think, paging through a manual. Do we really need all of them? With PE, I never had these questions because the approach is so streamlined. And although you'll find some critiques of PE in this book, it remains my platonic ideal of a treatment protocol. In sum, PE ruined me for other treatment protocols. In the year after first learning and practicing PE, during a postdoc focused on acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, I became interested in ACT approaches to exposure. ACT is a newer cognitive behavioral treatment with a strong research base. Even in the absence of deliberate exposure interventions, ACT has been described as an exposure-based therapy because it encourages people to remain in contact with difficult experiences they may otherwise avoid. As I moved away from using a strict PE protocol, I naturally gravitated toward approaching ACT-informed exposure with the simplicity I'd valued in PE. At the time I was first reading about ACT approaches to exposure, there wasn't a lot published about it. I combed through Eifert and Forsyth's exceptional ACT for anxiety disorders and a handful of published case examples and small studies. I informally chatted with experienced ACT clinicians using exposure and combed the ACT listserv for morsels. Along the way, I started creating my own ACT-informed exposure worksheets, trying to put theory into practice. I would revise these forms based on what seemed to work or not work with clients. Adrift from a consistent connection with a scientific community, I was more like a crank trying to make contributions to quantum physics from his backyard garden shed than a behavioral scientist. Throughout it all, my goal was to distill ACT-informed exposure into its essence. How could I orient clients to the ACT model in as few sessions as possible? What metaphors and experiential exercises connected to the widest range of people I worked with? What did exposure offer that traditional ACT metaphors and experiential exercises did not? Gradually, published studies of larger controlled trials of ACT-informed exposure trickled in. Initially, there was some talk that ACT-informed exposure may offer advantages over traditional exposure in terms of more people getting better or fewer dropouts. As research indicated that ACT-informed exposure and traditional habituation-based exposure appear to perform about equivalently on primary outcomes, that is, about the same. No better, no worse. I grappled with why a therapist might use ACT-informed exposure over traditional exposure, such as PE, especially therapists already comfortable with traditional exposure. Why learn a new model that appears no more effective than the old model? Traditional exposure promises symptom reduction, whereas the ACT model focuses on remaining in contact with discomfort to strengthen psychological flexibility in order to live a meaningful life. Why learn a model that feels more counterintuitive for clients compared to traditional exposure? Given that clients crave symptom reduction, why offer a treatment that denies them that? This book is the culmination of more than a decade of studying, reading, writing, and otherwise wrestling with ideas about ACT-informed exposure. It's been shaped through thousands of hours of clinical work with clients who've let us know, implicitly and explicitly, what works and what doesn't. As my co-authors and I began teaching trainees at our clinic and developing workshops on ACT-informed exposure, we further refined these ideas in how to present them to others. Our goal was to help answer the posed questions and make ACT-informed exposure as practical as possible. By practical, we don't mean simple, though. We love ACT theory. We've tried to interweave the full complexity and texture of ACT theory into exposure to help listeners creatively develop exposure exercises that address a wide range of client difficulties. As ACT is a process-based approach, more on that in the next section, We want to help therapists learn to flexibly use ACT across diagnostic categories and to think through exposures using the ACT Psychological Flexibility Model. In some ways, this is the book I wish I'd had when I first started working with ACT-informed exposure over a decade ago. From protocols to processes. In the 1990s, a task force was created within the American Psychological Association for evaluating the evidence of psychological treatments. Their goal was the development of empirically supported treatments targeting specific diagnoses. This movement was wildly successful, especially with anxiety disorders. Therapists now have access to commercially available, and even free, evidence-based treatment protocols written by experts in the field, targeting specific anxiety disorder diagnoses. PE, mentioned earlier, is an exposure-based treatment protocol specifically for PTSD. The primary creator of PE, Edna Foa, PhD, has a separate treatment protocol for obsessive-compulsive disorder. For a period of time, protocols flourished as more and more manualized treatments became available. The victory lap for evidence-based treatments was short-lived, however. Almost immediately following the success of empirically supported treatments, some researchers questioned the focus on diagnosis-specific treatment protocols. What about all the clients with comorbidities? Do we need to put them through multiple individual protocols? If so, in what order should we do so? What about clients whose difficulties don't cleanly fall within clear diagnostic categories? Another unfortunate side effect of the focus on protocols is the proliferation of approaches without regard to how these treatments work. Because protocols are typically tested as a package, they may have components that are not active in contributing to clinical outcomes. For this reason, randomized controlled trials, considered the gold standard in clinical and medical research, have sometimes been derisively called horse race studies. These studies look at whether a treatment wins the race, that is as effective or more effective than established treatments, but say nothing about the effectiveness of the individual components. A treatment may be shown to be effective in controlled trials, even if we don't know why it works, or whether each intervention in a protocol adds to the whole. As an alternative to individual treatment protocols, critics have called for a focus on developing our understanding of evidence-based transdiagnostic principles or processes of change. Instead of diagnosis-specific protocols, a process-based approach focuses on interventions that target evidence-based processes of change that help people across multiple domains. The idea is that clients will get more bang for their buck. Treatment might be briefer and more tailored to each individual than a protocol-driven approach would be. As an aside, process-based approach is different than the notion of common factors, such as therapeutic alliance, that are found in every form of psychotherapy. Something that drew me to ACT is its focus on process. Although ACT is not a pure process-based approach, it's rooted in evidence-based processes of change based on the psychological flexibility model. Yes, there are plenty of controlled trials, horse race studies, on ACT. At this writing, over 850 and counting, but there's also been an emphasis within the ACT community on understanding the mechanisms of change underlying ACT treatments. Research has found that components of the psychological flexibility model targeting core ACT processes of change can improve quality of life and symptoms in transdiagnostic samples of people seeking help. A large-scale study found that people with anxiety and a comorbid mood disorder improved more in ACT compared with traditional CBT for anxiety, which was more effective in people without a mood disorder. Additionally, ACT processes are relevant in other non-ACT treatments for anxiety disorders, such as traditional CBT and cognitive therapy. Exposure, for example, appears to strengthen ACT processes, whether delivered in an ACT context or not. We also believe there are personal benefits for therapists learning ACT-informed exposure. For example, an ACT approach to exposure therapy may help to increase therapist flexibility. The ACT Psychological Flexibility Model also offers an expanded vocabulary for talking about processes relevant to exposure for which there is not common language in other exposure models. For example, While the importance of emotional acceptance has been implicitly acknowledged in traditional approaches to exposure, newer acceptance-based treatments, such as ACT, make this process explicit, providing additional ways to talk with clients about how they relate to internal experiences. In our focus on ACT-informed exposure, our goal is not to bury traditional exposure, but to provide a bridge to ACT for clinicians experienced in older exposure models that focus on symptom reduction, allowing them to understand and integrate concepts such as acceptance and psychological flexibility in their exposure work with anxiety disorders. Getting the most out of this book. Unlike PE, we have deliberately stopped short of providing an ACT-informed exposure treatment protocol. Those who are completely new to exposure could benefit from learning a more straightforward exposure-based protocol first before jumping into this book. We have also tried to keep this book lean and focused on applications of ACT to exposure specifically. For example, the ACT literature is rich with many metaphors and experiential exercises to help people contact and practice psychological flexibility. In this book, we have deliberately limited focusing on specific ACT metaphors and experiential exercises so that these do not become calcified into a protocol. Instead, our focus is on exposure as an ACT experiential exercise. We see no difference between exposure and traditional ACT experiential exercises, as both allow clients to practice psychological flexibility. That doesn't mean the use of ACT experiential exercises is not also valuable in ACT-informed exposure, as the authors of this book regularly draw from a variety of common ACT exercises in orienting clients to exposure work. There are plenty of other resources available that we recommend you use to supplement your work, such as general books on ACT metaphors and experiential exercises, and ones tailored for anxiety disorders. As you embark on this process, we suggest you work through the exercises and begin creating your own ACT-informed exposure materials, customizing forms, worksheets, and treatment procedures that you can continue to revise and tweak over time. And we'll guide you through the process of doing this in Chapter 8. We want listeners to think carefully about the materials they use and how clients respond to them. We are always changing and adapting our own ACT-informed exposure materials as we integrate new ideas and new research into our practices. And we encourage listeners to do the same. Our hope is that you will come away from this book with a solid foundation on how psychological flexibility is strengthened through ACT-informed exposure, and that this new understanding will enable you to address transdiagnostic clinical issues more effectively. With that, we'll dive into Chapter 2, in which we'll walk through a brief history of the evolution of our understanding of how exposure works and why having a strong grasp of theory is helpful as a clinician. We will also begin to explore the unique insights ACT has to offer on why exposure works. Chapter 2, A Brief History and Overview of Exposure. When I, Brian P., was a little boy, I stepped on a nest of bees while walking through the park on a cool fall afternoon. I had wandered off on my own, happily exploring the grassy fields and nearby pond. Prior to this, I had no real experience with stinging insects like bees or wasps. Suddenly, out of nowhere, I felt an excruciating pain on my leg. I screamed, "What was that?" Then another sting and another scream. "What is happening?" I went into full-fledged panic mode. The stings kept coming, one after another, mysterious spikes of pain striking randomly all over my body. Luckily, a friend's parent came running over to help and began explaining what was happening. "You stepped on a nest of bees, insects that can sting you." Crying and in shock, I was thankful that there was an adult who seemed to understand the situation. Physically, I was okay. I did, however, develop a phobia of bees and other stinging insects. In the summers that followed, going out in the backyard was a terrifying venture. I began scoping out all the places bees liked to visit: flowers, bushes, puddles of water, and so on. I avoided going outside in the summer. When I did go outside, I had difficulty enjoying myself because I was on high alert. My parents did what any good parents might think to do. They coaxed me into going outside, reassuring me that I'd be okay, that I didn't need to worry so much about being stung. Yes, it can happen, they offered, but it's rare. The idea that we should face our fears is common sense. It's found throughout our cultural messaging and is the theme of countless movies, books, and songs. My parents were on the right track. Unfortunately, I remained terrified of being stung again, despite their best efforts. What was missing? Why wasn't their encouragement enough to face my fears and overcome my phobia? This chapter is about the importance of theory and why the simple idea of facing your fear requires a lot more sophistication and nuance than it might seem. We will provide a rationale for the importance of theory when working with people who suffer from anxiety, and will also provide a basic foundation in the history of exposure therapy, focusing on some of the main theories that have evolved to guide clinicians in helping people with anxiety problems. The importance of theory in exposure therapy. Why is theory so important? To provide an in-depth response to this question, let's consider the role of theory in exposure treatment. From a procedural perspective, exposure therapy, centered on basic ideas of helping people confront their fears, may appear to be unchanged over the decades since it was first discovered. A person with claustrophobia is encouraged to spend time in spaces that are difficult to exit, like an elevator. A person with social phobia is encouraged to make small talk with strangers. While this practice may seem simple and obvious, that is, confront your fear, the nuances of exposure matter greatly. Where do you start? How do you know if it's working? When are you done? Why does it work? Sometimes we receive phone calls from potential clients who tell us, "I've tried exposure, and it doesn't work." While not everyone benefits from exposure, these callers' descriptions usually align with one of the following scenarios. They tried exposure on their own once or twice and became overwhelmed. They worked with a therapist who offered a vague, unstructured version of exposure that wasn't grounded in theory. Perhaps the therapist used a cookbook approach or simply gave the client an exposure book and told them to follow instructions without offering guidance. They weren't prepared for the potential of symptom relapse since they didn't understand the theory behind how anxiety and exposure therapy works. Having a sound underlying theory is important in designing, implementing, and troubleshooting a course of exposure treatment. Theory impacts moment-to-moment clinical decision-making and is the bedrock for successful treatment in many types of cognitive behavioral therapy. Anxiety disorders are heterogeneous, with each individual client presenting with unique versions of anxiety. Theory is therefore critical when applying exposure therapy principles to the individual. While a cookbook approach based on a standardized treatment manual may be effective with many clients, without a grounding in theory, therapists may become stuck when clients are not progressing as expected, or if there is high complexity to the problem. When unusual situations arise, as they often do, it's helpful to have a model for guidance in making adaptations to the standard treatment course. The final reason we are highlighting the importance of theory comes from a more bird's-eye view of the evidence base for exposure therapy. Overall, about 49.5% of clients with anxiety disorders show a response to exposure therapy. There are several reasons for this. First, not everyone responds to treatment, and some clients experience only partial remission of their symptoms. Some proportion of these non-responders may be due to clinicians who lack the necessary skills and experience required to effectively deliver exposure. Second, some clients drop out of treatment. Third, some clients experience a resurgence of symptoms after treatment has ended. Taken together, these findings suggest that while exposure is an effective treatment, there is much room for growth in how exposure is delivered, highlighting the need to help clinicians improve how they deliver exposure therapy through improving and refining their understanding of theory. What, then, is the current theory underlying exposure therapy? Newer students of exposure are often surprised to learn that there is no single unifying theory. Researchers have repeatedly developed and updated multiple theoretical models across the history of exposure as our understanding of learning, neuroscience, memory, and anxiety has advanced. The authors of this book have devoted a significant amount of time to understanding exposure, in part because of our fascination with the constantly evolving science and theory and the ongoing improvement.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?